Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. With President Joe Biden facing growing public pressure to step aside after last week's debate, prominent upstate New York Democrats are divided on the question. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
Democrats are divided over whether President Biden should continue campaigning for re-election or pass the baton to someone else. Biden's family used a weekend gathering at Camp David to urge him to stay in the race. Former Niskayuna Town Board member Denise Murphy McGraw is the national co-chair of Catholics Vote Common Good.
There's no disputing that President Biden did not have a good night the other night. It was clear. It was visible to all of us. It was a painful hour and a half. I will say, though, as probably, I say with great confidence, one of the only people in the considerable WAMC listening area that has had a conversation directly with the leader of the free world over the last few months, when I spoke to him and when I was with him in person, he knew what day it was. He knew who I was. He knew why he was there. He was the leader of the free world. So I am not concerned in the least about his capacity or all these things that people are now saying.
State Assemblymember John McDonald of the 108th District is more concerned about Biden's policies than his performance.
Yes, the person is important, but the policies that impact everyday New Yorkers and everyday United States citizens is also a critical part. Joe Biden has done a remarkable job in regards to working for everybody in this country and trying to make sure that we've got jobs and we've got opportunity. And therefore, I can see why, you know, a lot of people are disappointed in his performance, and we'll leave it at that.
Policies aside, 110th District State Assemblyman Phil Steck worries the reelection campaign could be overshadowed by Biden's struggles at the podium.
I might be confident in the president as the president and in his policies, but I am not confident in the president as a candidate. I think the Democratic Party would be better served by a replacement. I think that, for example, a lot of this, when you're in a close race, a lot depends on perception. And you can talk about how important it is to defeat Donald Trump, but if the perception is that the president is not fit for this campaign, then it would be better for the party and for the nation that he step aside in favor of another candidate.
109th District Assemblymember Pat Fahey disagrees.
It's unsettling. These are unsettling times, but you have to go back to your core. And my core, you just have to go, who has demonstrated things? Who is trying to bring stability back to the Middle East, back to Ukraine? Do we want somebody who coddles up to Putin? I mean, it's just incredulous to me that it's even a race. How can we allow a communist dictator? If it's Ukraine now, what about Poland? What about the rest of Eastern and Western Europe? What about NATO? We can't be flippant about this. We absolutely cannot be flippant. We have a statesman, and we have somebody who is incredibly experienced. Yes, he had a bad night, but less than 24 hours later, we saw somebody, you know, who was the Joe we know. So let's go with the Joe we know.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has tapped a developer to transform the former downstate correctional facility in Fishkill, but the plan is facing skepticism from local leaders. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King explains.
Rochester-based Conifer Realty, LLC, has proposed turning the vacant 80-acre prison into a lively campus with commercial space, a walking trail, a playground, and lots of housing. Vice President of Development Momar Hermanstein says he imagines about 300 units to start off, but ultimately the site could host 1,300 apartments over the next decade.
There's tons of infrastructure that can work for what we're planning on doing if we sort of retrofit it correctly, which I think is just an amazing opportunity when there's an existing asset that you can kind of overlay and build over it, especially something that was as intense as the downstate correctional facility.
Hochul has proposed building on unused state land, including former prisons, to help combat the state's housing crisis. Downstate Correctional Facility was decommissioned in 2022. Hochul estimates its redevelopment will bring up to 200 construction jobs to the region. But that's not reassuring to Fishkill Town Supervisor Ozzy Elbra.
I have not seen one Fishkill resident support this project. Not one.
Albra, a fellow Democrat, says local officials have largely been in the dark on the deal, and the number of units proposed by Conifer would put significant stress on the town of Fishkill. He worries the increased population will clog traffic on Route 52. He says it might also require a new fire district, more police officers, and if enough kids are in the mix, new staff and classrooms at the Beacon City School District.
The way this is set up is that the residents of Fishkill are going to be paying for higher school taxes, fire tax, police coverage, and they're going to be sitting in traffic longer without any benefit.
The town board plans to vote on a position paper laying out its stance Wednesday. According to Albra, the town ideally wants to see the site used for commercial space, not residential, and it doesn't want it to fall into the hands of a nonprofit that could take it off the tax rolls. If it does become housing, Albra wants an emphasis on veteran and senior housing. He says a third of the units should be reserved for current Fishkill residents, and another third should be set aside for residents of Dutchess County.
I'm a father of four kids, a 22-year-old, a 20, 17-year-old, and a 13-year-old. And my children can't afford to live here. And I think if we can work with the state to get local people to get a preference for these apartments, I think we can move forward in getting something where the state gets what they want and the town and its residents get what we need.
Hochul says the plan includes a number of permanently affordable housing units. Just how many and how affordable they might be remains to be seen, however. Hermanstein says there's no set number of units or income level tied to this project, and Conifer is still waiting to hear what the local community wants. He envisions a lot of workforce housing at Downstate, at least to start.
You know, more of an affordable without the required restrictions affordability, affordable. Up to 80, maybe even up to 120% AMI.
According to a recent report by the nonprofit Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress, which worked with Conifer to draft the proposal, according to Hermanstein, the average single renter cannot comfortably afford a one-bedroom apartment in any of the region's nine counties. As for Albro's concerns, Hermanstein says his data shows the number of students at Beacon City School District has dropped over the years, so he imagines it can take on more. He says Conifer plans to hire a traffic consultant and meet with local leaders to gather input from the community. Republican State Assemblyman Anil Bipan of the 105th District says his office is collecting comments from residents to bring to the table.
It sounds like this is going to be a negotiation. It sounds like the Conifer group has come in with their highest possible wish list of what they would like to do for development there. I think over the next couple months, the town should theoretically have a say in, you know, bringing that number down to something that's a bit more realistic. We're hoping to keep the lines of communication open between Empire State Development, the Conifer Group, and the town.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Deanna Fox. She's the new CEO of the New York Farm Bureau. We We talked about the state of farms in New York and how farmers and farms fared in the recent legislative session.
It doesn't matter what commodity you're working in, if you're a dairy farmer or you're a grains farmer, doing row crops, doing poultry, and doing aquaculture, it really doesn't matter what you're doing. The needs are the same, really, in any part of the state, whether you're in Buffalo or the North Country or Long Island. There's a lot of regulation in New York State, which makes it hard to farm. New York isn't always a very agricultural friendly state, and it's gotten progressively less friendly, I think, with some changes in politics. So people need more help. They need people to understand what farming is, what agriculture is, what the makeup of farms in New York State are. 99% of the farms in New York State are multi-generational family farms. Some of them might be big, but they're not factory farms. They're not corporate farms. They're run by your mom and your dad and your uncle and your cousin and your third cousin and your cousin once removed. Like, it's all very generational and family driven.
And let's pause there, because you're making a demarcation here. A lot of folks are attuned to the problem with factory farms and some of the pollution and even some of the problems that can happen with E. coli and other things. Now, there are protections, but there's not a lot of enforcement power, especially when you talk about the USDA. But in this case, you're saying most of the farms here in New York, they would be considered locally owned or regionally owned farms.
They are. And there's a lot of regulation that comes on the environmental level, especially with water, related to municipalities. So there is federal oversight. There is state oversight, but there's a lot of county and municipal oversight. And our farms are primarily located in areas where there's fewer people. So there's more people doing multiple jobs, which means that your neighbor might also be your selectman for your town or your town supervisor or your code enforcement officer. So the interpersonal politics of running a farm also become very tricky. And so we try to help our farmers navigate that as well.
Well, I believe I read the number one foodstuff in New York is yogurt. Is that right?
Well, dairy.
Dairy.
Yep, for sure. So we are one of the leaders in dairy in the country. Probably half of our farms in New York State, at least the ones represented by the Farm Bureau, are dairy farmers. And there's a lot of consolidation in dairy. So it used to be stanchion milking, maybe had a couple hundred head of cattle that you were milking at any point. Now those farms are consolidating. There's fewer farms, but they're bigger. So it's a different operation than it was even 20 or 30 years ago. So the makeup of dairy farming has changed just in the operations. Now we have people who are milking their cows with robots. It's really amazing. The technological advancement in dairy farming is just incredible. It's unmatched in terms of other types of farming. But there's a lot of regulation around dairy farming because cows emit methane. They take a lot of water. It takes a lot of crop to feed them. So it's very highly regulated. And also, we want to make sure that dairy stays safe. There is, you know, issues related to avian flu, bird flu in dairy, not in New York State.
Yep, so
we haven't seen that
York.
Yet, but it is in, I think, 12 other states throughout the country. So it's here and it's present, and there has to be regulation to make sure that our milk supplies stay safe. Right now it is. But then you get involved with federal and state and local regulations. So what we do is we kind of help farmers figure out what those regulations are, what you can do on your farm to protect it. If you do get an infected herd, what you need to do to make sure that you're not spreading it to other cows, to other herds, to other farms. So it's a lot of regulation to be a farmer. You almost have to have somebody on hand who can go through every day and look at the USDA website to make sure you're getting the most accurate information, because it changes very fast.
Let's talk a little bit about the end of session and the budget. What were you happy about when it came to legislation in the budget this year?
Yeah, we actually had a fantastic year with our wins and the things that we tried to make sure didn't pass this year. One of the big ones that we got this year finally was direct-to-consumer shipping on cider and distilled products in New York State.
Alcohol, folks.
Yeah, so now there's some parity between all of the craft spirits, all spirits made in New York State. Before wineries could ship and breweries could ship, that really came from the pandemic. They've been able to do it since the pandemic. But now all of the different types of spirits, booze, beer, wine, you can ship it all. If you go and visit, and it's been great for agritourism, because if you're going out to the Finger Lakes or you're going out to Buffalo or you're going somewhere where there, or Long Island, where there's a lot of craft beverage production and you don't want to ship all that stuff home, you don't want to haul it home with you, you can now have it shipped directly to your house. And that's been pretty fantastic.
Hey, Deanna Fox of the Farm Bureau, how about Indian Ladder Farms right here in the Capital Region, which also, and this is something I find interesting that I've seen happening more and more with farms in New York, and tell me if I'm right, and that is partnering with other organizations. Mm-hmm. So DeFazio's Pizza partners with Indian Ladder. Mm-hmm. Indian Ladder has craft beer that they sell. Now there's a little area at Indian Ladder Farms for a little pizza area and cafe.
It's fantastic. So this is where you see a lot of farm diversification. We see a lot of that in our farms where once upon a time, maybe Indian Ladder was able to just sell apples. New York State is one of the top three apple producers in the country. But people now, they don't want to go and buy their Macintosh and their Cortlands and their Empire to make a pie. They're looking for the Honeycrisp and the Fuji and the Gala and the Pink Ladies and the things that have a shorter harvest period. So you have a more concentrated group of people who are coming to pick them. It's more concentrated if you're hiring labor outside of the farm to come and pick for your harvest. But then what? What do you do from there? The money isn't there to really just only do that. So now Indian Ladder is a great example. So they make cider, but then they started making beer. So they got their farm brewer's license. They're growing hops. So they've created another commodity.
You can go and pick a number of different fruits and vegetables.
You can. And now they're working with somebody like DeFazio's, who, you know, we love from the Food Friday days.
Yes.
And bringing more people onto the farm for different reasons. But it lends a different level of, you know, regulation and different understanding of what you need to do if you're going to branch into those other kind of agritourism. From the insurance underwriting perspective, it's a different type of insurance that you then need for your farms, the regulation, when you have people on farm consuming alcohol, what that looks like. So that's really what we do. We help our farmers figure out. And it's not just farmers. We have about 12,000 members across the state who are adjacent to farming, that work in agribusiness, or people that just support farming and want to give their, you know, it's a pretty small fee, I think, for what you get as a Farm Bureau member. And we advocate tremendously for all of our members.
That's Deanna Fox, the new CEO of the New York Farm Bureau. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Historic Saranac Lake is planning to celebrate an historic link between the Philippines and the Adirondack Village in August. In advance of the event, the group held a virtual meeting featuring the grandson of the first democratically elected president of the Southeast Asian nation. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley has more.
The village of Saranac Lake rose to national and international prominence in the 19th century for its treatment of tuberculosis at a time when there was no cure for the disease. 80 years ago, then Philippine President Manuel Quezon came to Saranac Lake for treatment and died there. New York University adjunct professor Louis Francia, who has written a history of the Philippines, says President Quezon was a pivotal figure in that country's history.
He represented the transition from the Spanish era to the United States occupation / Commonwealth government. And therefore, he is important in the sense of understanding the way that the Philippines transitioned into the modern era.
Manuel Quezon III, the grandson of President Quezon, shared photos and explained how the Philippine president came to Saranac Lake to be treated.
It was a good friend of his, a former governor general of the Philippines, a former congressman from New York. We owe it to Francis Burton Harrison, his friend, who said, "Have you heard of this little town called Saranac Lake? Because it's a place famous for a certain Dr. Trudeau, who happens to be one of the world experts in this disease." And that's what brought him to Saranac Lake in 1943.
Quezon, who has not been to Saranac Lake, recalled that during the COVID pandemic, he was contacted by a fellow Filipino who had just visited Saranac Lake and was sent pictures of the places his grandfather had stayed.
And all of a sudden, what had been a color film from 1944 suddenly became digital images from 2019. The same deck, the same view of the lake, something I'd never seen. The living room of the house unchanged practically in at that point 75 years. The chapel where he lay in state for the last time. And even an interesting detail, a steamer trunk that apparently had been left behind and led to intense speculation among myself and my cousins about what's in that trunk. We better retrieve it. Well, to add to the drama of this story, now the trunk is missing.
Cazon says while his grandfather's life culminated in what he calls a death in exile during World War II, Filipinos still respect his memory.
On the whole, and I'm just stating this as someone who has gone around the country and been fortunate to interact with many people, I do think there's still a tremendous amount of goodwill about my grandfather and his memory. There remains a positive impression, if only because of his insistence on national pride and our national existence.
Historic Saranac Lake Executive Director Amy Catania said the virtual meeting is one of a series leading up to a President Cazon History Day in Saranac Lake.
It's going to be a day of a special museum exhibit, some dance performances, a ceremony to welcome important guests, and also some musical performances and Filipino food. So our little village is really excited to have this day on August 3rd.
Historic Saranac Lake's President Cazon History Day is supported by a grant from Humanities New York.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
A controversial herbicide was used in Lake George for the first time after a judge declined to intervene. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella-Levine has more on the controversy.
Judge Robert Mueller, who had blocked the use of the chemical in 2023, denied a request for a permanent injunction against the Lake George Park Commission's proposed use of Procellacor, which is deployed to combat invasive Eurasian water milfoil. Mueller was not very enthused to deliver his ruling to a courtroom largely packed with those opposed to the pesticide's use.
I believe and know that I'm to follow these agency determinations. And I don't have the discretion to ignore them, and they're there, and they're clear, and they're easy to understand. I may not agree with them. I don't agree with them. But I don't have any science to support anything like that. I have the obligation here to act procedurally. And procedurally, the application before me is to demonstrate irreparable harm, the likelihood of success on the merits, and balancing the equities. When I take all of those formulas together, I just can't conclude that the injunction that was issued ex parte should stand. And so that's my ruling.
Following Mueller's decision, the LGPC had roughly 48 hours to apply the chemicals before its permit would expire. Had Mueller delayed his decision any longer, it would have been another year before Procellacor could have gone in. After years of debate and legal challenges delaying the herbicide's application, Procellacor was used in two bays in Lake George early the following morning. Dozens of locals who opposed the chemical's use lingered outside the courthouse.
Yeah, devastated to say the least. People's drinking water should not be messed with so easily in a non-democratic process.
Takayuki Kokabu is concerned what impacts long-term exposure to the chemical might have on his 15-month-old daughter, who is nestled in his arms.
There is not enough caution in these things, especially when it comes to children, of toxic exposures going on all over the place, as we can see from just illness all over, you know? And yet we tend to just err on the side of industry instead of health.
Opponents, including the Lake George Association, point to a study by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture that links the herbicide to so-called forever PFAS chemicals. Proponents of the chemical's use say it dissipates to undetectable levels within days of application and does not impact other aquatic plants or animals. Dominic Jude owns Aqualogic, a company that specializes in hand-pulling invasive plants from lakes in the Northeast. He's one of the few people at the courthouse who supports the decision, even if it means putting him out of business.
It is nearly impossible to eradicate milfoil through diver harvesting from specific areas. There is a limited effectiveness to it, and so this is really the only way to control the milfoil in our water bodies and to keep all Adirondack lakes safe. The Procellacor came out in 2017. It's been incredible to observe. Again, we don't do Prusalla core treatments or applications. We only talk about the effectiveness of diving. But we've seen it, for example, it was used on Brant Lake a couple weeks ago, and we've watched the milfoil die.
The LGA offered to cover the costs of another year of hand-harvesting Eurasian water milfoil and claimed the plant does not pose as dire a threat to require chemical treatment. LGPC Executive Director Dave Wick promised continued transparency following the application.
This has been utilized in hundreds of lakes throughout the Northeast and over 1,000 across the country. It's been used in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all across Europe. So we're not doing a science experiment in Lake George. We're doing the smallest application of Prusalla core that I've been able to find anywhere in the country, and we're doing it to out of an abundance of caution, just to do two very small treatments. We will study these sites more than any other lake has studied the outcome of these sites.
The Lake George Association was unsuccessful in petitioning New York Governor Kathy Hochul to halt the pesticides application until further research could be done. LGA Executive Director Chris Nowitzki spoke with WAMC following the ruling.
As of right now, I think we've taken this as far as we could have to prevent it. Now it's try to understand what happens when, you know, a pesticide is put in a pristine lake. And in our opinion, it doesn't meet the criteria of its use.
Opponents contend Lake George is much larger and faster moving than any nearby lake Prusalla core has been used in. The LGA is monitoring Sheep Meadow and Blair's Bay in collaboration with the Jefferson Project and expects the efficacy of the pesticide and potential damage to other species to be measurable after several months. Reporting on the campus of Skidmore College, this is Aaron Shello-Levine.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2427. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.